It gives me much joy to be able to welcome all of you to our 2007 convocation. This convocation can be a life-changing experience, especially for you who are here for the first time. It certainly was for me when I attended my first one in 1953 at India Hall at the Highwood Ashram Center. That was my first experience of an SRF function, and I arrived a little late, never having gone there before, so that as I entered the India Hall, they were just having their opening prayer, and all the devotees were standing there with their hands in pranam. And I had never seen that before. And the first thought that arose in my skeptical mind was, man, that looks weird. But then, overpowering that, came the powerful sensation, the powerful thought into my consciousness, I'm home, thank God, I'm home at last. And that thought has never left me. I had become convinced before coming to the first class, which was an energization class, that somehow it was going to help me in a particular troublesome physical problem I was having at the time. And it did. And I found the entire convocation to be helpful physically, mentally, and spiritually. On the last day at Mother's Center came the highlight of being blessed by our then-president, Rajarshi Janakananda. Later, I met a young man who was wearing street clothes but had a large ribbon badge with a lotus atop and the word renunciate under it. And being brand new, I asked him, what did that mean? And he explained to me about the SRF monastic order. And there was immediate response again arising in my heart and in my mind. And I said, that overpowering feeling was there. That's what I want. And right away, the ego countered with, cool it, man. I mean, you've only found out about this organization and everything looks fine, but slow down. And so I thought, well, okay, I'll give myself 3 years to practice these teachings and see whether they work or not. And if they do, that's definitely what I'm going to want to do. Well, it didn't take 3 years, and 9 months I knew that that was what I should be doing with this lifetime, and so I applied for the monastic order and was able to enter the SRF Order of Self-Realization in 1955. For me, it was right, and I think the smartest thing I'd done up to that time. 52 years later, I still feel it was the smartest thing I've done. It has been a wonderful life. There are tests and trials because these are necessary to help us work out our karma. The end result, however, is understanding, a spiritual maturity, a love that expresses itself in serving others joyously. When we do that, we cannot help but find that our own cup of happiness is full, is automatically full, because that's the law. And you all can have it. You can make that joy a part of your lives. That is why I am so happy that all of you are here, that you have earned the opportunity to spiritualize your life through the teachings of Self-Realization Fellowship. Joy is like its precursor, love. The more you give, the more you have. The more you give it away, the more that comes to you. Now, Guruji said a very important statement. A strong determination to be happy will help you. A strong determination to be happy will help you. Whether we are cheerful or not depends somewhat on outer circumstances, but mostly on our attitude of mind. And that depends on how we take life with its successes and failures, pleasures and miseries, healthy times, times of sickness, desires fulfilled, desires denied. It really comes down to character. Happiness comes not so much from what we have, but what we are. How are you responding to life's changeable drama? Positively or negatively? Now, recently a new book was released, the seventh in the series, and it created quite a sensation. Why were so many people caught up in the story that they could hardly wait to get their hands on the last installment? No doubt because the author knows how to tell a story, how to make it interesting, how to grab the reader's interest and attention. Because she creates a drama that in its outward circumstances is quite different from our lives, and yet in the emotions of its characters, quite similar. Fascinatingly different, and still the same, so that we can relate to it. That is the work of an excellent author. Do you perchance think that God is less an author? In his drama of century being expressed on this planet, we need to learn to enjoy the drama of our lives with that kind of interest, and yet be able to experience it with a certain amused detachment as though it were a novel happening to somebody else. The same way we can read a novel like that and enjoy it and get something out of it. So that when this life comes to an end, we will be able to look back upon it and say, this was an interesting life, full of twists, unexpected turns, humor and sadness, contentment and joy, failures and accomplishments. I learned much from it. Because that's what we're here to do, to learn from it. Or in the words of our divine guru, whatever comes in life, just take it joyfully, impersonally, as you would a motion picture. Life is entertaining when you do not take it too seriously. A good laugh is an excellent remedy for human ills. One of the best characteristics of the American people is their ability to laugh. To be able to laugh at life is marvelous. And I might also add, to be able to laugh when the joke is on us is also marvelous. This my master, Swami Sri Yukteswarji, taught me. In the beginning of my training in his hermitage, I went about with a solemn face, never smiling. One day, Master pointedly remarked, "What is this? Are you attending a funeral ceremony? Don't you know that finding God is the funeral of all your sorrows? Then why so glum? Don't take life so seriously." He taught me that one must be mentally above every crucifixion of earthly experience in order to find complete happiness in God. She came, ran downstairs one morning, lighthearted, as only a child can be. She rushed into the kitchen and noticed that her mother wore a glum expression. "Mommy, aren't you happy?" "Of course I'm happy." "Well, you sure haven't told your face yet." Remember to tell your face. So again, as Guruji has said, we should actually go out of our way to make others happy. And he said, we won't be able to please everyone, but to those we interact with, we should do our best to give them kindness and love. And never forget to smile. Not a smile that's pasted on your face, but lacking sincerity, like a mask that one can buy that has a perpetual smile on it, frozen in place. a frozen smile without any feeling behind it, but an honest-to-goodness radiant smile that comes from a joyous heart, a smile that can be worn by the good, but only vainly attempted by the wicked. Our divine guru tells us, "In a time of misfortune, I heard thy voice saying, in my native language, Bengali, the sun of my protection shines equally on thy brightest and thy blackest hours. Have faith and smile. Sadness is an offense against the blissful nature of spirit. Let my life-transforming light appear through the transparency of smiles. By being happy, my child, thou dost please me." We please God by being happy. He sent us here to enjoy this creation. To enjoy it. And we can enjoy it by living in it the way we should. So Guruji said, "When you smile sincerely, the Prince of Smiles is canopied beneath your celestial brow. Your soul smiles through your heart, and your heart will smile through your eyes. Protect the Prince of Smiles in the castle of sincerity, and see that no rebel hypocrisy lurks to destroy it. Every time the spiritual man sees sad faces, he shoots some buckshot of vitality-spreading smiles at their owners. As soon as he comes upon a sorrowful heart, he shoots into it sympathetic smiles and kind words. The minute he sees someone overwhelmed by clouds of sorrow, he disperses the gloom by the continuous cannonading of his courageous smiles. Whenever the heart of sorrow is pierced with a bullet of a smile, he scores a bullseye. We should have target practice every day in shooting smiles into the body of sadness. We must shoot sorrow on sight. We can kill the blues with a trigger of wisdom." So those who have become wiser in life do their best to overcome difficulties, but first, last, and all the time, they smile. Why? They have realized the great power to overcome failure or other negative effects of delusion that resides in a genuine smile. The best panacea for sorrow, the best revivifying tonic in one's struggle for happiness is a heartfelt smile. A true smile of wisdom and peace glowing on one's face is the most beautiful ornament that one can wear. Bombarded by constant worries, the mind grows old quickly and causes the body to appear unhealthy and old. But a smiling mind, wearing a smile on the face despite any adverse physical, social, or financial conditions, helps to keep the body looking young with firm flesh even as it becomes aged. Proper exercise and a healthy diet also help. But above all, remember, you are the infinite, which has become the body. The body is a manifestation of spirit, is the ever youthful spirit. And Guruji finished his comments on smiles with these beautiful statements. "God is like a match of smiles." Just think of that. Life is mostly darkness. We stumble along, but when we see people smile, it is like a matchstick struck in the dark that drives away the gloom. Let God smile through you. The pure heart, by its transparency, lets in the divine smile which reflects in the face. Wherever you go, you should run and make a bonfire of all sorrows with a matchstick of your smiles. The fire needs a breeze. Without a breeze, the fire won't spread. Just so, with your smile. It must be a smile raised by the divine breeze, the breeze of divine joy. Laughter of the infinite God must vibrate through your smile. Let the breeze of God's love spread your smile in the hearts of men. Your fire will then be contagious. Your divine smiles will chase the gloom from others' hearts. So all of us are seeking happiness in life, aren't we? We all want to be happy. Just as all of us are seeking love. We can't deny it. We all want to be loved. And indeed, if we stop and really look at it deeply, we all also want to love. We may be sometimes somewhat reluctant to express that kind of feeling to someone else for fear of rejection or whatever. But it's really a very natural thing because it comes from our true being, from our soul. It comes from God. Soul is a part of God. And that is a natural thing for it to want to be able to receive and express. Now, Master sent me all over the world to talk in many different places. And I've often heard people and seen people, some happy, some sad, some miserable, some just perhaps bored with life. I've had those that came up and asked me how they could make their lives more happy, more joyous. But I've never once had someone come up to me and say, "Brother, could you teach me how to be more miserable?" We aren't looking for misery, are we? Not at all. People try to avoid pain and want. That, again, is natural. And seek happiness, or more correctly, joy. Now, the dictionary defines joy as great pleasure, great happiness, or delight. And it defines bliss, which is a synonym for joy, as extreme happiness, spiritual joy. Extreme happiness, spiritual joy. Now, to attain that, there's one quality that we also have to have within us. And we all do probably to a certain degree. And that is, we have to have hope that no matter what difficulties life is sending our way, we have to have hope of our ability to overcome them and for life to move on in a more joyous way. We need to have hope to believe that we can make the grade, pass the tests of life. Bhartri Hari made an interesting saying. He says this, "Hope is like a river, desires the water therein. Avarice is the ripples, and attachment to the objects of the world is the alligators to be found in it. Doubts are the waterfowl." That was an interesting one when I saw that, doubts of the waterfowl. And then I thought, okay, you know, have you ever seen a giant heron, for instance, standing along a stream, waiting motionless for a fish to swim by so he can stab it, toss it in the air, and swallow it? Like that. Don't be stabbed and swallowed by doubt. Glamour of the world is the whirlpool in it. Cares and anxieties, the slippery banks, slowly exposing the roots of the tree of contentment that stands there. How difficult to cross the river of life. Blessed is the mystic who does so with a pure heart and attains to joy. Pure heart attains to joy. So make up your mind that you will be that blessed one who crosses safely over the river of life and finds joy. Why should you doubt? You have found your guru, who is himself the raft. You have the techniques he brought that are the oars. Life is passing. Get busy now. Apply yourself. Row, row, cross over that river of life and find there the goal of all life, joy, bliss. And the interesting thing is that bliss is God, not that God is blissful. God is bliss. Now, the most useful definition of God that I have found is in yoga philosophy. And it basically says God is such Chidananda. Three words and a single concept. God is Sat Chit Ananda. Sat means being, life. Chit means consciousness or awareness of that life. And Ananda, of course, means bliss. So we could say this definition of God in English is God is ever new, conscious, blissful existence. And we're called human beings. We exist in and attach to a human body. And generally speaking, we think of that body as being ourself. We think, we get up and look in the mirror in the morning and we see that form there and we say, oh, that's me. Don't look too good today. And yet that body is merely the vehicle, along with our minds, that we use to operate in this material creation. We also have two more subtle bodies, the astral body of light and energy, the ideational body of thought, ideas. When we are in the less gross astral part of creation, we are astral beings, and the material body has been left behind. When we graduate to the causal creation, only the thought body remains. When we return to spirit, no bodies remain. Yet we remain a free soul. It is no longer I am that, it is simply, I am. I am. I exist. I am. That is the goal of life. Let's go back down the ladder a little bit. It's how we can make life more interesting, more entertaining, more joyous while we're still in this physical creation, because that's where we are now. And here is where we have to find that joy and happiness, right here, where we are, where God and karma, our karma have placed us, right there. We can find it. We can have it. Have you ever tried, as Guruji said, to catch that will-o'-the-wisp of something else, which still dances in the background of your feelings at the end of your accomplished desires? Analyze it. You hanker after something as long as you are not able to get it. But when it is secured, sooner or later you tire of it and you want something else. I'm sure you've all noticed that. When there is dispassion and severing of body identification, bliss consciousness arises in us. As Long Master said, as you are human, you cannot help but have desires. That's natural. Being human, how then can you realize your divinity? First, have rational desires. In other words, think your desire through. Don't just go chasing after every desire that automatically pops in our mind. Some of them may not be good for us to have. Think about it. Is it a good desire? Then stimulate your desire for nobler things, all the while trying to attain bliss consciousness. You will feel that the cord of your individual attachment to various desires is being automatically snapped. That is to say, from the calm center of bliss, you will ultimately learn to disown your own petty desires and to feel only those which seem to be urged in you by a great law. So Jesus Christ said, "Not my will, but thy will be done." Those which seem to be urged in you by a great law. That is, those that are necessary for us to play our particular role in life and work out our karma, and requires some spiritual maturity to be able to do that. Mr. McCain was an old chap, and he was sitting around a pot-belly stove in Vermont some years ago, swapping tales with some of his cronies. And he was complaining, saying, "My body's all crippled with rheumatism. Can't get around much anymore. Hurts like blazes when I do." Why, just yesterday I was saying to God, "I don't know why you bother keeping me around here, Lord, in this condition." "Well, McCain," said one of his friends, "if the Lord's keeping you around, it's because he has work for you to do." McCain thought about this for a minute. "Well, I ain't gonna do it." How many times have we felt the same way when something came up in our lives that we know we should do, some responsibility we had to carry out, something that someone needed to be done, and the arrow of fate was pointing at us and said, "You're the one who has to do it," and we didn't want to do it. It's interesting, you know, the nature of our desires, as we have said, is that as we begin to fulfill them, we find out that as soon as we fulfill one, two more spring up to take its place. And the process seems to be endless. It goes on incarnation after incarnation after incarnation. Now, suppose you had an incarnation in which everything came together to provide in that life everything you craved. Health, wealth, position, power, friends. After a while, it would not be enough. You'd no longer feel contented. You'd become restless again, dissatisfied with life, on the prowl for that something else which would fill the lack in your heart. Now, as we said, it's a natural force in physical creation to seek to fulfill our desires and find our happiness therein. That's a natural thing. But we don't want to seek things that will provide just a little pleasure in the beginning, but later bring remorse and suffering. So whenever we want to fulfill a desire, we should think about would help us to really achieve the goal we want. Because if we don't achieve the goal we want, then that will probably bring dejection, perhaps even frustration or anger. One of our senior monks shared this with me, a true story that was told to him. Many years ago, a world-class runner in the 400 meters shared something he experienced at the Summer Olympics. He called it a life lesson. In the 400 meter finals, he finished in third place. Distraught and angry at himself for not being able to run his best because he had run one of the fastest times in his particular event that year, he felt himself slipping into a very familiar pattern of beating himself up and entering into a dark mood. Ever had that experience? We all like to beat ourselves up sometimes, don't we? A little later, with his mood in full blossom, he was asked to meet some important people from his country that were attending the Olympics. He didn't want to meet them, since he felt so miserable, but felt it was his duty as an athlete representing their country. Amongst the group was a very small boy with his family, maybe 4 or 5 years old, who had a very deformed lower body. There was a wheelchair there, but he was using very small customized crutches and with help was able to get around. He was bubbling with happiness, almost exploding. He was saying over and over again, "You did it! You did it! You did it!" And struggling, he managed to struggle over to the athlete and grab him around the legs and press his head to him, all the while saying again, "You did it! You did it!" The runner did not have the heart to tell him that he didn't win and felt very uncomfortable with the group looking on. But the little boy went on joyously and breathlessly saying, "You ran fast! And you ran fast all the way to the end. You did it. You did it." Instantly, everybody present knew the little boy did not care who was first, second, or third. He only saw that the runner ran as fast as he could all the way to the end. In his mind, that was the race. And perhaps he was running it as fast as he could from start to finish in his own mind. Everything changed at that moment. I hugged the little boy and twirled him around. People laughed, happily recounting the race, saying, "How does it feel to be one of the fastest men alive?" Another said, "The bronze medal gives us 3 more points in the standings." Everything became positive and joyful, with all the people joined together in one voice congratulating each other. And lo and behold, my mood and all of my focus on self disappeared in a flash. The little boy's joy, enthusiasm, and purity lifted everyone up to the rafters and out of themselves. Happiness is always just a heartbeat away. When you are fortunate to receive a life lesson, hold it to your heart, examine it, make it your own, and a small part of your life will never be the same again. Now, isn't that a touching story? And one that we can take to our own hearts as something that when we come into a situation like that where we feel disgruntled with our achievements, that's not the end of life. Learn the life lesson from it. Why did we fail? Not that we failed. Why did we fail? What did we not put forth? Did we not make the effort we should? Did we avoid it? What was the reason behind it? If we can learn the life lesson from the experience, that can change our outlook, not only on that, but future experiences. Our outlook on life can become more positive. So all these outer things that we're seeking, you know, there are many things we seek after them, and we get them, and they're nice, but have you ever noticed something very interesting? All the pleasure you get out of something, whatever kind of experience it may be, outward experience, 10 minutes later, it's only a memory. You can think about it, but that doesn't feel the same, does it? It's already just a memory. It's not the same as when you were experiencing it. It's now just a memory. And that's why probably we go back again and again doing it, trying to revivify that memory in our mind, because the memory is just an inferior imitation. We want the genuine experience again. So people do something again and again, despite the results always being short-lasting and therefore unfulfilling. That we continue to do the same thing and yet expect to get different results shows how we are fooled by delusion. Does it not make more sense to seek joy directly instead of through temporary material sensations? Why not go after joy itself? In the story that was just told, happiness was chosen in an indirect way. The adults could have remained unhappy, but the child saw the experience as happy, and his happiness was contagious. So happiness can be contagious, sadness can be contagious, black moods can be contagious, all these things can be contagious. What do we want to go around spreading since we're contagious one way or the other? What kind of contagion do we want to spread in this world? Happiness? Sadness, dark moods, joy, it's up to us. There was an elderly man, he'd been crabby all his life. He was known to be the biggest crab around. He constantly complained about everything that happened. Then one day, he changed overnight and was cheerful and happy. And his friend asked him, "Hey, what happened to cause the change?" "Well, all my life, I've been waiting for things to change so I could be happy, but they never did. Dang it, I just decided to be happy anyway." Hey, it's up to us. If you want to be happy, no one can make you unhappy. If we're getting tired of unhappiness, hey, be happy. Just decide like that man, "Hey, I've had enough, I'm going to be happy." And of course, we want a happiness that is continually new, because otherwise, even with happiness, we get bored. And that's the beautiful thing about bliss. It never becomes boring. It's always new. It's continually changing. And that's the kind of happiness we want. It's sort of like, have you ever seen a waterfall? It's always the same, and yet it's continually different, because it's continuously changing, and yet it remains a waterfall. That's the kind of happiness we're looking for. Now, I remember one time many years ago at Mother Center, and I'd gone to our three-hour meditation, which is at the end of our work week. It had been a very busy time, and the mind was caught up in a lot of restlessness and outward activities. So I was trying to do the best I could, so I decided, well, the first hour I'm going to practice Hong Sao. So the first hour of the meditation, I practiced Hong Sao. At the end of the first hour, I was just as restless. The old monkey mind was still jumping around. So I said, okay, Om. So I practiced Om technique for the second hour. At the end of the second hour, still wasn't there. So then I sort of got mad. And I said, okay, Kriya Yoga. And I started practicing Kriya with intense determination and focus, because I'd had enough of that. And by the time that third hour was over, I was literally bubbling with joy. So when everybody else got up and left at the end of the meditation, I just sat there to continue to enjoy that feeling that had been created by that meditative effort in Kriya Yoga practice. And then after about 10 minutes, very interesting what happened. I began to feel that I wanted something else. The restlessness came back. There was something else I wanted. That something else. I didn't even know what it was. I just knew I wanted it. So I got up, left the meditation where everything had been great, went over to the kitchen. You get a lot of happiness out of food, you know. Went over to the kitchen, looked around. What is it I'm looking for? Pulled out an apple, took a bite. Nope, that's not it. Went and looked something else, took a bite. Nope, that's not it. Third thing, I went and got that, took a bite. Nope, that's not it. And then it hit me like a brick wall. You idiot. You had it. And you got up and walked away from it, looking for something else. Think about that. How many times have we done that? It's because our mind is still restless and untrained. We haven't trained the mind yet. This usually happens more often early in our sadhana, when we haven't learned to become still and when we haven't learned to practice what Guruji said. When you have a good meditation, or even if you haven't had such a good meditation, as good as it can be, don't get up immediately after you practice your techniques or finished your meditation. Sit there and hang on to it as long as you can. Otherwise, we become like that musk deer. Remember the story in the lessons of the musk deer? This beautiful smell, at a certain stage in the musk deer's life, there's a sack in the navel that breaks, and this beautiful musky smell comes out. And the deer is absolutely captivated by it. And he dashes all over the mountain looking for that beautiful smell. With such He becomes so frantic that sometimes he jumps off a cliff and actually destroys himself looking for that smell. And yet, there it was all the time, right inside himself. And isn't that the way we are in looking for our happiness? The greatest happiness that we can find is right inside ourselves, and yet we go running around everywhere else trying to find it. What causes it? Well, before we get to that point, suppose we continue to meditate deeply and regularly. The old habit gradually loses its power. Then we go beyond nibbling at the edges of bliss and sometimes reach that state where we can remain in it, completely satisfied, with no longing to do anything else. But when we return to ordinary consciousness, then the old desires sooner or later crop up again, so even Nirvikalpa Samadhi is not enough. Nirvikalpa Samadhi brings sensation, the end of all physical desires, and only with the attainment of oneness with God does all desires cease. All these things which distract us from God. Remember this chant? Desire, my great enemy, with his soldiers surrounded me, is giving me lots of trouble, O my Lord. That enemy I will deceive, remaining in the castle of peace, night and day, in thy joy, O my Lord. What will be my fate, O Lord? Tell me. Pranayam be thy religion. Pranayam will give thee salvation. Pranayam is the wishing tree. Pranayam is beloved God. Pranayam is Creator Lord. Pranayam is the cosmic world. Control the little pranayam. Become all-pervading pranayam. You won't have to fear anything anymore. Now, there's an ancient yoga text reputed to be over 5,000 years old. Some of its sutras I found very inspiring. This is one of them. He who is everywhere is joyous. Think of that. He who is everywhere is joyous. Now, what does it say in that chant? Control the little pranayam. Control that life energy in your body. Become all-pervading pranayam. Become that pranayam that pervades the universe. Then you won't have to fear anything anymore. And you will be joyous on top of it. So, of course, there was this particular chant. The composer of the chant was comparing God to pranayam, which is not, of course, exactly correct. He would use poetic license there. But still, since God may not be identical with any method or technique, yet of all the ways of reaching him, pranayam is the quickest and most holy. Now, we've been given those ways. Follow them. If we are not yet getting the joy we are seeking, if we are not yet satisfied with the results that we have, don't blame the ocean of God's consciousness. We have to blame our diving. We are not meditating correctly enough, deep enough, long enough, desirous enough. Our longing for God is not great enough. When you sit to meditate, you have to be on fire for God. You have to want that. You have to, don't just sit and meditate out of habit. When you sit to meditate, cultivate that intense longing for God. Cry for God. In the beginning, we talked about the 53 convocation. And the thing that changed me most in that convocation was meeting Rajarshi Janakananda, our second president. At that time, he was our president. And I was there at the lower level down at the tennis courts, and a friend that got me started in SRF came by and said, Rajarshi's up there at the street level up above blessing people. Why don't you go up and get his blessing? And I'm brand new, remember. I've had six classes, and I'm thinking, blessing, blessing, what's that? Doesn't sound dangerous. Maybe I'll give it a try. So I started to walk up the stairs, which go up parallel to the road for ways, and then there's a landing. By that time, you're up high enough, you can see who's up there. I could see Roger, as I turned the corner to go toward the street, I could see Roger C. standing off there with his back mostly toward me. And I started to walk up there to get closer. And as I did, about halfway there, he suddenly turned around and looked right at me and literally froze me in my tracks. And we just stood there for a moment and looked at each other. And then he turned around, and my feet came unglued, and I walked on the top and watched to see what was taking place. You know, I wanted to see the drill. How does this happen? How am I supposed to act? I saw the people go up to him like this. I watched several go up, and I got in line. I went up to him, pranamed. He took my two hands in his left hand and touched me here at the spiritual eye. And I knew enough, of course, by that time to look there, so I was looking there. I never saw any light. I never heard any sounds or had any feeling of love or bliss. I sort of felt like a lump of dirt. And so I opened my eyes and I looked into his face. I'd never seen a face like that in this life. There was such peace coming out of that face. There was such love coming out of that face. There was such joy coming out of that face. And when he turned my hands loose, I literally staggered several paces beyond him and stopped and thought to myself, I don't know what that man has, but I do know one thing. I want it. I want it. Recall the story of Mr. McCain. He didn't want to do what God wanted him to do. Let's contrast that with someone who did do what God wanted her to do until the very last breath of life. That someone was Sri Gyanamata. Gyanamata said that her strength came from her complete surrender to God and Guru. At night, just before falling asleep in this last period of her life, she would turn her gaze inward to the spiritual eye and quietly say to God, "Now, Thee alone I seek, send what is best." Some of my moments during these last 3 weeks with sister, said another nun, were almost too sacred to divulge. But I realized that only through personal contact with a saint can we get to know some things about her. I believe that throughout the 22 months that I was with her, taking care of her, sister was unable even to draw a deep breath without pain. Yet she never complained about anything. The night before her passing, when I left her, she asked me to lock her door on the inside. When I was outside her room, I noticed that it was so quiet inside that I wondered if she was still breathing. I started to go back in, but as I was entering the room, I heard her exclaim, "Master, Master," sharply, as if he had been with her, but vanished when he heard me at the door. Another nun who was present when Gautamata spoke her last words said, "They came a short while before her passing. Sister's face was radiant. A big smile illumined her face, and she exclaimed, 'What joy! What joy! Too much joy.' Within an hour, she was gone." Too much joy. I think we'd all like to get that, huh? Too much joy. The lives of the great ones show us we can achieve it. We have to keep on to the end, even as she did, even as Gurdjieff did, even as everyone who attains that goal keeps on, unflinching, life after life if necessary. But remember, Gurdjieff has said, those who get Kriya Yoga, they're almost there, getting close. And that we can arrive at that goal in this life, or if not in this life, in a few lives thereafter, if we are determined to achieve that goal. It's really up to us. God cannot give it to us, because he's given us free will to receive it or not, to seek it or not. It's up to us. We can make our lives happy. It's basically character, as we said. It's basically our character, what we do with life, how we react to life. And so there's a few things we might say. A few things to summarize. We all want happiness. It's the birthright of the soul. Lasting happiness is not found in external experiences, not in material objects and sensations, which are short-lasting, not in material wealth or position, not through catering to material desires. True happiness is found within, in meditation, in the love of God. The joy of meditation increases and endures. God is the source of all happiness and joy. His nature is bliss. Other factors and happiness? Making the mind strong. Cultivating the determination to be happy at all times, in all circumstances. Following health laws, keeping the body fit. Following the eternal laws of happiness, truthfulness, honesty, self-control, consideration for others, self-improvement, making others happy, seeing God in them, serving that God in them, living simply, that is, putting a hedge around our desires, keeping the company of joy-filled minds, learning to be happy and cheerful, smile from the soul, smile now, come on, smile now, thank you. Be sincere, smile at all times, give joy to all, smile the smile of God, which is the smile of bliss, the smile of happiness. So that is what we are looking for, and that we can have. God put his immortal children, and hey, that's us, in this physical creation. We're supposed to enjoy the beautiful and the good, not become cynics, hating his creation and condemning others. We need to discover the blissful attitude of our eternal soul nature, perpetual joy. Those who delight in the material things of this creation without discovering the inner joy of God become materialists. They think that's all there is. Georgie said it is a disgrace to behave like a discontented mortal, chasing one desire after another, when you are made in God's immortal image of all desire, quenching joy. When material souls behave like mortals or egos, they experience the dualities of their ego natures, pleasure, sorrow, and so on. So we have to get rid of that temporary ego nature which we have grafted over our soul nature. And the Guru has given us the means to do so. He's given us the techniques. He's given us everything we need. There's one thing he cannot give us. He cannot do it for us. We have to do that. And, you know, that's not too much to ask. I mean, it's the old, remember that old rule, 25, 25, 50? 25% is our effort. 25% is the Guru's blessing. 50% is the grace of God. But Guruji said, you have to do your 25% 100%. In other words, we have to make an effort. We can't, God's already given us a pretty good bargain here. I mean, stop to think about that. We just have to work out 25% of our karma. So we shouldn't go back to God and say, hey, come on, God. Isn't that, how about 20%? 15% maybe? No, we have to do our 25%. And what happens when we do our 25%? By doing that, we do that by following what our Guru gave us. And what does that cause to happen? It brings attunement with the Guru. Now he can help us more because we're attuned to his consciousness and what he wants. We're not fighting him all the time. We're working with him instead of so often against him as we may in the beginning through lack of understanding. And when that happens, then when we add the Guru's blessing to our efforts, that brings God's grace. Now we're at that state where God's grace can come to us. And that can come to us in different ways, perhaps just a desire, a greater desire for God, an ability to practice the techniques deeper. We don't know how it will come. But if we do our part, it will come. So let us close with Guruji's words of wisdom, his benediction to all who truly follow this path. Meditation is the pickaxe that pries up all the covers of consciousness and brings forth the fountain of God's ever new joy. Meditation, complete relaxation or conscious withdrawal of the mind from the restless senses, is the only way to know God. Even though you may be able to do everything else but meditate, you'll never find joy to equal that which comes when the thoughts are silent and your mind is tuned with the peace of God. If you ask, how do I know there is such a joy as you describe? This is my testimony. If you practice meditation every day, deeply and consistently, you'll find that ever-existing, ever-conscious, ever-new joy ever-increasingly manifest within you. And with practice, it will stay with you in activity and silence alike, even in sleep. It is a joy that will constantly guide you to right action in everything and will respond to your prayers. You have to demonstrate that for yourself. And this is my further testimony, that once God's joy has been found, all desires for other gain will dwindle in comparison. Your consciousness will expand. You'll be able to stand unshaken amidst jarring trials. The whole world will not be able to lure you to forsake the bliss which you will find in meditation. You will enjoy all other things in that divine joy. Get it. God bless. Jai Guru. Have a great convocation.